Hello? You guys got me? Don't know, I'm trying to. Hello? Hey, it's Shane, Gino, LIO. Ready for a sound check. Oh, I think they got me now.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Good. That
Can you
sounds
hear me?
great. Yep.
Sounds good? Okay.
Yep.
Okay, how about this one? Check,
Yep.
check, check. And this one.
Sounds good.
Does that sound good? Okay.
Yep.
And how about this one? Is
Sounds good.
that good? And this one?
Sounds good.
Good. And how about now? Can you hear me now?
Yep. Sounds good.
Okay, this one?
Yep. Sounds good.
Okay. And last but not least, how's this one?
Sounds great.
Great. Okay. Thanks, Shane.
Yep, no problem.
See you later.
Yep.
the House Finance Department Law Budget Subcommittee to order. It's about 10:37 on Tuesday, January 28th. Members present are Representative Josephson, Representative Ledoux, myself, Chair Holmes. And today we've got an overview from the Department of Law, an overview and a fiscal year 2015 presentation by the Attorney General, who's here in front of us. On your members' desks, there should be some department summary information, which I actually recommend that you take a chance to take a look at, especially before we get later in the month or next month. We're going to be doing some of the updates on ongoing litigation. There's some very interesting information in the stuff that I've handed out pertaining to that. So I recommend that you take a look at that. With that, Mr. Attorney General, feel free to introduce yourself and anybody else you'd like and take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mike Garrity. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Alaska. You know, with me today is the my Chief Deputy in Charge of the Criminal Division, Rick Svobodny, Chief Deputy in Charge of the Civil Division, Jim Cantor, and Administrative Services Director, Dave Blaisdell. We are here to discuss an overview of the department and what we expect to coming up this next year.
And I'll just interrupt you to say we've been joined by Representative Keller. Welcome.
Sorry, I'm late.
We just started. No problem.
Let me just start by reiterating our what we characterize as our four missions and as far as the department is concerned. The first is, and these are in no particular order, but one is fostering the responsible development of our natural resources. The second is promoting good governance. The third is protecting the state's fiscal integrity. And the last is protecting Alaskans, of course, and our criminal division is primarily in charge of. Just to take the last up first as an example, the challenges we face, and it's hard to say whether it's a trend or not, but in Anchorage, and this is not for the whole state, but for Anchorage, which is obviously the largest jurisdiction, and where we have the most activity, in 2011, we had 130 combined trials, misdemeanor and felonies. In 2012, we had 146 combined felony misdemeanor trials. Last year, for the year just ended, 2013, we had 178 trials combined. We maintained a conviction rate of about 75%, give or take a point here or there, but that's been pretty consistent. So, it's hard to say that's a long-term trend, but over the last 3 years, it was a marked trend, which I noticed.
So is your trend consistent with the increase in population, or are we having more crimes, or is somebody just getting better at arresting people?
I don't have a scientific answer for you, Representative Ledoux, but I think, as you know, in recent years, the legislature has gotten very tough with domestic violence. We've increased sentences for a range of offenses dealing with domestic violence. There's a mandatory arrest provision in the law, and as a consequence, I do think we see more of those kind of cases going to trial, because in many instances, the stakes are higher, especially with the sexual assault and those kind of crimes. And so that's one part of it. I instituted a new plea negotiation policy earlier this year, which modified how we went about negotiating agreements with the defendants who had been charged. At least in Anchorage, of the 178 trials that I mentioned for the whole year, 68 of those occurred after August, which is I announced the change in the policy around August 1st in July. And so I don't consider that a significant uptick, because of the change in plea negotiation policy. Now, I think it's a little soon to make definitive judgments, but at least in the short term here, we did not, because the policy went into effect right away. But
and this is a change from what to what?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Oh, yes.
The put in broad terms, we department had a policy in years past of when it did a Rule 11 plea agreement, all aspects of plea and the sentence would be negotiated.
Thank you. We've been joined by Representative Stoltz. And Representative Stoltz, we're going over right now the change in plea agreements that were was introduced by the department in August, and the Attorney General's explaining that change to us.
They're fessing up now.
And as I was saying, the public, in my view, didn't have enough information when it considered all these plea agreements. Now, I will say that thousands and thousands of cases are resolved every year without any controversy, and their appropriate dispositions. There's not a problem. But it is the cases that get the attention that I think color the public's perception of how the criminal justice system works. And in my view, if a defendant wants to accept responsibility for his crimes, and is willing to plead and the charges, I mean, the prosecutors are still free to negotiate appropriate changes in the charges or the number of counts that are being pled to and so on. But there's limitations on that as well. But, I mean, in general, you can still negotiate a charge disposition. But in terms of sentencing, it was my belief, and my view, that that belongs with the judges. I did not want our prosecutors to set or fix sentences anymore with a defense attorney on serious crimes, DV crimes, and so on. I think if you look at the policy, it doesn't apply across the board. It applies to about 20% of our caseload, and it's the more serious, high-profile cases, the felonies, violent crimes, and so on. So in those cases, defendants, as I said, if they want to admit responsibility and come forward, we will go in and argue for a sentence that we think is appropriate and proportionate to the offense, and the defense attorney is free to argue what he believes that the sentence should be, and the judge will decide what the sentence will be. In years past, that would all be agreed to. We agreed to the sentence, probation conditions, and everything, and I had issues with that.
Follow up? Yep. So can there be an agreement between the defense and the prosecution as to what the prosecution is going to recommend?
No. No,
not
I mean,
even what
I think they can have a discussion about it, and we've had discussions internally about whether we should about agreeing to, for instance, a range, a bracket. You know, the defendant.
But not even necessarily because it's up to the judge's discretion, but an agreement as to what the prosecutor is going to ask for.
Not
an agreement
really.
As to what it's going to be, but
no, not well. I mean, I think they can have discussions about it. I'm not sure we have the policies were rigid about that. We have said we're not interested in a wink and a nod type of agreements that you're going to ask for this and the defendant's going to ask for that. It's that type of thing.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome, Attorney General. How would you compare this with? And bear in mind, I was in high school and I just at the time, and you were probably in. Much younger than that. Compare this to the edict or the policy that former Attorney General Gross did, I believe, in the late 70s. How does this compare with that, and how would you?
Well, I was actually practicing law when Gross did his policy. His policy was much more far-reaching and far-ranging. He banned.
It was an absolute
plea bargaining. Absolutely banned plea bargaining.
That was my recollection, although only as an observer, not as a participant in the process.
Of course.
And it, you know, there was many predictions that this was the end of the world as we knew it, and they didn't come to pass. The Alaska Judicial Council did studies about it, and I think there was uptick in trials. But what it led to, I believe, is more careful investigations, more careful referrals or screening by the police, more careful screening by prosecutors and charges and charging decisions, decisions probably in the defense part as well, but so it's not nearly as far-reaching as that, and we will continue to plea bargain, as I said, because the policy does not cover the 80% of the cases that we handle, misdemeanors and so on.
So when I was practicing law, I kind of vaguely, because this is when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth, I kind of vaguely remember that.
I do remember the dinosaurs.
I kind of vaguely remember this no plea bargaining policy, which was in existence, but then it seemed that people were still plea bargaining. I mean, did it ever change officially?
I think I did. It was taken quite seriously by then Attorney General Gross, and there was official pronouncements, edicts.
When did it change so that plea bargaining was okay again?
Well, exceptions were carved in to the rule. Mr. Svobodny's study this morning, I have, and then he's free to supplement this. But there were exceptions were starting to carve into it gradually. Attorney General Cole finally abandoned it and said that he thought it was a tool that the prosecutors should have in their arsenal. So in the 1978, then Attorney General Gross instituted, late 70s, and then Charlie Cole, I think it would have been in 92, officially ended. So in between there, I think there was a transition, but the official end of the policy occurred in 1992. So in any event, the policy is, I meet with the judges. I'm meeting with Judge Vollen, the chief criminal judge in Anchorage, the 4th. This month I met with him earlier this fall. I met with the judges in Kenai a couple weeks ago. I'm going to meet with the judges in Fairbanks and just get – it impacts the court system as well, obviously. If there's – when judges – when you do a change of plea and agree to a sentence, as I said before – prosecutor would present a plea deal, which had all aspects of the deal agreed to, and then the judges said yay or nay. And the vast majority of the times they said they were okay. But so now it would require the judge may want a pre-sentence report done by the corrections. If he's going to be doing the sentencing on his own, using his discretion, he wants to be as informed as he can, obviously. So there is impacts. We thought about some of them. Some of them are unattended, and we're evaluating them. So I think it's still – we're still – studying it and looking at it, but I have no plans to terminate it or to jettison it at this point. But so it changes. I met with the prosecutors, the district attorneys week before last, and for 2 hours, and got a lot of feedback and input from them and some good ideas. So we will be continuing to evaluate it and tweak it, if you will. But I'm satisfied and comfortable with the basic concept of the policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. General Garrity, I was told that part of this new position of the department won't go into effect until late July this year. Do you know what that refers to?
No, if it was something I said, I apologize, Representative. It went into effect in late July of this year.
Right.
Of 2013. I apologize. I did say this year. It was July of 2013, or late July, August 1st of 2013.
Sure. If the court system, because of a potential uptick in trials and the need for sentencing hearings where there's going to be victims and all the rest, rather than some of that would occur even on a full Rule
yes.
11, would the court system be warranted in needing additional staff to cover the additional time?
You know, I'd have to defer to the court system. We had been told that they have requested an increment of $200,000. Now, that's secondhand. I have no information about that. We at the Department of Law have not requested any additional funds as a result of the policy change or implementing the policy.
Okay.
Representative Stoll?
Yes, thank you, General Garrity. As you know, since 1994, Alaska's had a constitutional amendment enhancing the crime rights of victims and specifically delineating them. Where has the implementers of this, along with others, Office of Victims' Rights, what has been the conversation involving them, and what has their interaction been on this issue of plea agreements on behalf of the constitutionally protected victims?
Well, they still, they're say in the plea.
I don't know what their status will be. Have they been involved in this discussion as implementers of our constitutional rights for victims in Alaska?
No.
That is. Do you think they should be?
Well, I'm not sure they should, Representative. Because under this great change, victims will have more say, in my view, in what happens because,
that's the trust me part of government. Not everybody's always that comfortable with it.
If
it's going to be a good deal, invite them to the table.
Well, it's
then they'd be allies.
The victims' rights?
Yes.
And,
Yeah. They're legislative-created implementers of the...
Fair point. I will say that we, since we've implemented, we've not had any feedback.
We'll make sure they're invited to the table. I'd rather have you invite them.
Well, I certainly can, Representative, and I don't mean to slight them. As I said, I think under the new policy, what happened under the old policy, and this was another issue with me, was that victims do have to agree to pleas. But what would happen, in my view, the prosecutor has got to deal which they think is fair and appropriate at the disposition. And if they go to the victim, it's to sell the proposal. And I think many victims tend to be a little bit apprehensive, a little bit afraid of bucking the system. And the prosecutors present them this information and explain why they could lose their case and why this might happen and some why this is a fair sentence. And I think many times, if I may say, victims just go along. Now, under this new policy, we're not going to stick
them. Victims' advocates don't always go along, though.
Well, but I can't speak for the victim advocacy system.
You can speak to them.
I can speak to them, and I'd be happy to take it up with them.
I think, Madam Chair, I think I've made my point. I felt I was not getting there, but now I think it's there.
No,
I
think
we're there.
Well, I appreciate it, and we will follow up with the
Mr. Sabani can say there has not been an attorney general of any stripe that I haven't grilled on this issue. It's about the victim's issue. It's not about our current attorney general.
No.
So don't you're getting lighter treatment than others.
I appreciate that, and the point's well taken.
Oh, absolutely.
Get off your track, but this is.
Nope, that's
a passion I've carried over from past lives.
I appreciate this. This is something that we reached out to the Department of Law as soon as we heard about the change earlier in the summer and have been monitoring it. And so I think this is a highly appropriate conversation. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even though we're here to talk about your budget ultimately, I think we're a curious bunch, and so I'm just curious about something myself. When I served the department as a prosecutor, I never was told that I had to get the agreement of the victim. I was only told I had to inform the victim of the settlement. Did I do it wrong, or is there some change in the policy?
Well, I don't think you did it wrong, Representative. Yeah. I'm sure you didn't through your service to the Department of Law. I think it depends. I think it depends on the case. Certainly victims of violent crime, families of victims of violent crime, and so on. I hope and I believe that we inform and consult with those people very closely about what's going to happen. And as I said, even if there is a plea agreement, they're free to show up at these sentencing hearings. But we, as Representative Stoltz mentioned, that is very important to me. And as I said, I think there's gradation. There's people who their house may be burglarized, their car may be broken into, and stuff like that. Those people are victims. Mm-hmm. And they have we have a responsibility to respect their voice as well. But certainly the ones I'd be most concerned about are the victims of serious crimes, violent crimes, a loved one's taken, something like that. Those people we need to stay involved with. So I don't think there's been a policy change in terms of how we keep victims informed. There shouldn't be. And our intent is, and Mr. Svobodny agrees, is that we want to work closely with victims and make sure they're informed and they understand and they agree to whatever the case may be. As I said, we can still do charge agreements. So those, we can still, the defendant can agree to plead to X number of counts or a count that may be one level reduced from what he was charged with. So those, again, I don't want to do that unless the victim has some understanding and we consult with them and let them know about it. But again, it depends on the crime, obviously.
And I guess if there aren't further questions on this at this time, there are two aspects to this. One is the right public policy, and the other part, of course, that this committee is also looking into is the funding and to the extent that there's any funding ramifications. But obviously you're hearing that above and beyond the dollars, this committee is very interested in the issue. From a policy standpoint, I would strongly encourage you to reach out to the Office of Victims' Rights on this, and we'll be following up, and I'm sure you'll we'll be talking about this subject more in the future.
Well, well taken. I agree, Madam Chairman, and I appreciate the Representative Stoltz's remarks and for adding that dimension to to our analysis and then to our discussion. So I appreciate that.
Madam Chair, can I ask one other one other policy question? I promise only to talk budget after that.
I'm a policy geek, Go ahead.
There was a citizens initiative, an act providing for protection and conservation of Alaska's fisheries, your on the advice of your department, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell rejected that initiative, the citizens initiative. Mm-hmm. Another assistant attorney general signed for that. Signed that document. I was wondering, what was your role in reviewing that as Attorney General? Did you have any role in reviewing it, or was it all subordinate Assistant Attorney General?
No, it absolutely. It happened under my direction and in my involvement, and we had a team of attorneys that studied it very closely. We had a number of discussions about it internally with Fish and Game, and so it was fully thought out and a decision that I was very involved with.
And what did Fish and Game add to the their fish managers? The question of whether or not it was an appropriation. Mm-hmm. What did they add to the discussion on the issue of the matter that it was an appropriation?
Well, just facts. We're not fishery scientists. We're not fishery biologists. We don't know all the opening.
How would other management decisions be relevant to whether or not it's an appropriation?
Well, it's just background, Senator. I mean, Prime Representative, it's just background. I mean, I want to make as well-informed decisions as we can, and I'm not a fisheries expert. I don't understand all the openings and closings and the species that are affected, and it's just to get information about that. I mean, they had no the legal analysis, but I'd like to get all the facts that I can in making a decision.
And was the ultimate decision was made by that Assistant Attorney General was the first and last decision made on the legal?
No, it was my decision.
Was there an initial decision by an assistant attorney general that differed?
I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of it, Representative. I'm not sure it's appropriate, but I that is my decision. I was very comfortable with it, and we look at all sides of these issues very carefully over a period of several weeks. And
well, I just wondered if it was your – and I'm not trying to be combative, but this is an important issue that there's some questions if – and if you can't talk about whether or not another attorney within your department had made a different decision, and it's absolutely your decision, why wasn't it signed by you to put that punctuation point on it as opposed to an assistant attorney general?
It's a protocol that existed before I got to the department. We have attorneys who advise Lieutenant Governor's office, and we just follow the protocol. Those decisions I'm very much involved with, and we get a team of attorneys. It's not any one attorney, and we have a back and forth in an open exchange, if we get as many facts as we can, and we arrive at the best decision we can.
So are we getting into an attorney-client privilege issue here?
Well, I think I hope I've answered your question. I'll try to answer another one if there is one, but I'm not sure what is the question now.
Well, my question was, you said you couldn't answer it, and you weren't going to get into it, whether or not another attorney had a conflicting opinion that was asserted. But is that part of an attorney-client privilege?
No, Representative. What I'm trying to say is that when we have an open and free-ranging discussion on issues like this, people play devil's advocate and they have preliminary views, and we have a group of seven or eight attorneys discussing an issue. People take different views. We read the cases. We come back and discuss it again. So people take different views, but through that process and that give and take, we get to a consensus. And that was a consensus, and I agree with it.
Representative Ledoux?
I guess I don't want to belabor this point either. But on a court, for example, there's always going to be give and take between the justices, and they generally try to arrive at consensus. But sometimes you can't arrive at consensus. So then there's what's known as a dissenting opinion. So I guess I'm just sort of curious. Was there anybody in that room where you discussed this who might have been able and willing to write if given that opportunity? the dissenting opinion?
Oh, I'm sure as attorneys we could have assigned someone to do that. And you know, there's
been anybody who would have liked to have written the dissenting opinion?
That I don't know, Representative. I mean, let me say this. There's the Supreme Court has expressed a preference before. We're all aware of it. At least we are in the form of law that, you know, initiatives, there's a preference or presumption, if you will, that initiatives should go on the ballot. So with that, that weighs heavily with some people, and it's kind of, well, let's just put on the ballot. You know, it's not so much a legal analysis, it's just, let's just put on the ballot. I mean, the Supreme Court said there's a presumption in favor of initiatives. Well, that said, there are cases in which the Supreme Court has said that's not an appropriate subject. One of them is the Pullen case, which had to do with the allocation of salmon resources in the Kenai. So it does happen that they refuse to certify initiatives. So
worthy. We'll leave that for other discussion.
Anyway, I don't mean to parse these questions too fine. I mean, I can just tell you, and I assured you, I mean, that was a decision I fully agreed with. I was fully involved in every discussion we had as a department involving that. So, and we may be wrong. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be challenged. A lawsuit's been filed challenging it, and if it is, you know, we'll read the decision, be informed, and move on. But I'm not going to have any second thoughts about it or doubts.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Well, let's keep going until we hit the next one.
Well, let me turn to our budget's being reduced for FY15 to the tune of about $3.5 million. We're going to be reducing six positions total in the department, and as well as one LOA. But so, as I said, we've got challenges to meet, but one of the main things I want to do is to, and the way I look at the Department of Law is we're one Department of Law. We have a criminal division. We have a civil division, we have a natural resources section, environmental conservation, we have all these sections, but we're one department of law, and we're all attorneys, and there's still 290-plus attorneys in the department, and we just need to use our resources more effectively. I don't want to compartmentalize the department. I wouldn't throw, you know, a civil litigator into trying a felony case, for example, or vice versa, but we do have a number of attorneys who come from the DA's office. We've had a number of attorneys from the civil side go to work for the DA's office, so many people like that variety and those changeovers. So I think we have tremendous resources and tremendous potential in the department to serve, as I say, kind of cross-pollinate, if you will. Some examples are this summer we had the fisherman trial going on at Bethel. It was 20 defendants left who were challenging their citations for fishing during a closed season by relying on subsistence, religious principles, and so on and so forth. We took attorneys from our civil section to work on the briefing for those constitutional issues. And we had one actually attend the trial in Bethel for a couple weeks to participate. We've had issues come up about in the criminal context of whether, for example, the state's obligated to provide interpreters for jurors. And, you know, there's because of the ramifications of that issue, we jump in. We have assigned some civil attorneys to work with the ADAs who are handling the matter and go to the hearings, go out to Bethel, wherever the case may be. And so I strongly believe in using all of our talents and to some extent getting people a little bit out of their comfort zone. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. We have volunteers for these things. It's not like we have to push somebody in a direction they don't want to go to, but I'm certainly going to encourage attorneys to get out of their comfort zone and do as much as they can. Another example is CHINA appeals, Child in Need of Aid appeals. Those are handled by our Office of Permanent Section doing Children's Services. Those are all virtually all contested matters. You go to hearing, you're terminating a parent's right. Very emotional cases and very difficult cases. And as recently we've had a real influx in those appeals. And, you know, ideally we would like the attorneys who handle those cases below, the trial attorneys, handle the appeals as well. But the numbers just became overwhelming. And because they have the trial attorneys and Children's Services have still ongoing cases and things to do, we took to farming those out within the Civil Division. The law, there's a body of law you can learn that the Supreme Court's established, and it's not like we farm them out indiscriminately. I mean, and you can get a few people who are good in that area or write a brief in that area and build on that and give them more cases. So I believe strongly that we've got the resources and we'll get the job done. But we are losing these positions. But those are some examples that I think we can use and we can build on. I think there's other examples as well. You may have heard there's a brewing issue with criminal appeals, primarily from the Public Defender's Office and OPA. But right now, the delays between when a defendant files an appeal and when his brief is actually filed is well in excess of 300 days. And it's got to the point where the Court of Appeals is getting more and more comfortable with it. They came out with an order very recently saying they're going to ratchet that down. They're not going to give extensions of time. And then there's a schedule laid out in the several-page order. I mean, but over the course of the next couple of years, they're going to ratchet down that time. And so, and we have time as well. We need time to respond. So if there's more criminal appeals being filed, they're more timely, then it could impact us as well. But I've talked to Rick, and we've talked at the Civil Division, but I'd like to see us help out on those appeals as well. We all take, as lawyers, we take criminal procedure, criminal law, and law school. Many of the appeals are for sentence appeals, for example, sufficiency of the evidence. Again, they're not. And they'd be triaged by the Criminal Appeal Department. They wouldn't obviously send over complex appeals, but there's many appeals that I think we could handle over in civil to help out. We're going to monitor the situation, do that as it turns out we need to. But I think that's another area where I hope to build on our department-wide resources to help a specific division, criminal appeals, and keeping up with what may be some impositions or increased demands on them as this order takes effect.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Question from Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Attorney General Garrity, the court system is going to ask for a couple million dollars more, and I've learned that the public defender, Mr. Steiner, has said we're not going to be contracting out as much. We've got to freeze that process, contracting out with outside counsel, because there can't be this reliance on a supplemental appropriation, I think is essentially it. It strikes me that even though you're looking for a decrease, and that's a whole other discussion, at some point it's in the interest of all these branches, including OPA, to function as best they can. And it doesn't matter who the winner or loser is. It just needs to work.
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, it's your sort of marching orders that there be a reduction of seven positions.
Six attorney positions, yes, and one law assistant.
All right. And if I could follow up, the six attorney positions, are those currently filled? Were they just there? In a holding pattern, as it were.
Well, not all of them were filled. We had one, for example, a statehood rights attorney. We had been in the process of filling two positions that we were given by the legislature last year. One hire we did make. Before the second hire came along, we realized we were going to have to make some sacrifices here and suck it up a bit, and so we did not fill that one. I think there's And then how these will be implemented, Representative, is just by there's retirements right now that have been announced that we're aware of, and so on. And you know, there's a normal course of resignations and people leaving, and so on. So we're going to be doing it very judiciously, very carefully. But and only three of those would come from criminal, three will come from civil. And as I said, we'll monitor it very closely. But
so just to be clear. Two of the seven were unfilled.
I think that's correct. I can clarify. I know at least one was, but I'm not, and I believe one in criminal as well. But I could be mistaken. But I can certainly clarify that, Representative Nivens.
And so what was the department free to use monies from those two positions to fund other activities at its discretion?
Well, the statehood rights attorney that I'm sure of, that was just funded last year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been eliminated. The other attorney position, I'm frankly not sure. In my understanding, OMB looked at all positions that have been unfilled for 2 years, and those of all the PCNs have been taken away. I don't know that impacted us at the attorney level. If I'm mistaken, it did impact us in the LOA level.
Mm-hmm.
We had some unfilled positions like that. So,
okay. I guess just as a quick statement, I know that you work for the governor, and I don't, and sometimes I feel like I do, but I don't. And I just want to make sure that this body really can get a sense from you or one of your subordinates about real need, so that people aren't working 14-hour days. And this subject came up last winter as well when I was sitting here. I think it's my position that we have the resources. And so I just want to be clear about that.
Well taken. I mean, and I don't disagree with the representative. I don't want people working the 14-hour days either and burning people out and pushing the good people away. I will say that in my 2 years as AG, I've not seen that happen. Not been brought to my attention. There is a normal turnover. It's difficult to be a prosecutor. You've been there, done that, and so it's, I don't. So there's a normal expected turnover, and as far as I'm concerned, that's what we've seen. But there's an ebb and flow for several attorneys on this panel, and there's an ebb and flow to the practice of law. And sometimes you're preparing for trial, and things are going pell-mell, and you're stretched. Other times, the case is you're going pell-mell, and the case settles, and so you find yourself with a little bit of a window and an opportunity. So there's those types of things I hope to take advantage of, and I think but it's something I'm going to monitor very closely, and my deputies will as well. And I hear what you're saying. I don't consider this to be cutting into the arteries of the department. As I said, we started at about 298 attorneys. So I think these are cuts that we can withstand, and I may ask more of people. But there's a lot of people who want to like that. They're challenged by it. They enjoy it. I mean, some older folks may not like it, but they're used to their routine. But people who are ambitious, young attorneys with energy who like to work on interesting cases and do challenging things, Department of Law is a good place to be, and I think it'll remain that.
Thank you. Sorry to indulge that.
That's a good one. And if I may just comment, I know that we're seeing a number of departments go down by positions this year, and it's a good question as to how many of those were vacant versus how many are actually going to be bodies that you're used to having there that aren't going to be there in the future, whether it's through retirements or whatever it is. So, I mean, that's, if you're eliminating a position that wasn't filled to begin with, then, that's money that's going away, but not a body that's going away. So it's, it's a relevant discussion.
Well, very relevant. And I apologize if I implied otherwise, Representative.
Oh, no,
and I can get information and be more specific and drop an email to you or your staff if you would like. But I know there's at least one, I think two, but I stand correct, and I can find out and update you with that information.
And of course, we are a system. We've got the... You've got the prosecutors, you've got the public defenders, you've got the courts, you've got the Office of Victims' Rights, you've got a lot of different players, health and social services, you've got a lot of, it is a system, and there's got to be a balance. And so that's something to pay attention to if one part of the system is asking for increases and another isn't, or things are adjusting. It's something that we need to, I'm sure you're very aware of. I'm not.
Absolutely.
Of keeping the whole system in balance so that we don't have hold up in one part or the other.
And the House Finance Committee could help tremendously by advising the departments that appear before them that you're not going to let them reduce their budget by reducing their legal services.
Yes.
That's the double whammy for us and people,
mm-hmm.
and that's the cheap decision we can make. Oh, we're going to spend less on attorneys. that's penny wise and pound foolish. And so when we started this process with OMB, I cautioned them against letting departments do that. And as far as I know, that hasn't taken place because, again, that would affect us.
I have the number of conversations I've had with clients where they come to me and say, can you fix this? And I say, had you asked me 2 months ago, I could have fixed this easily. A little bit of consultation on the front end can save a lot of heartache.
Ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So, moving on, and again, please interrupt. I want to talk a little bit about our facilities because we're also undergoing changes there. We moved last year. Our Fairbanks District Attorney's Office was in a really bad location. I visited the office myself when we moved. We're across the street now from the courthouse and facilities that are much more secure, much more suitable for the department. We currently have renovations undergoing in Bethel. We had a real, and we're not the only state office, but Bethel had a crime need. We were completely jammed up out there in the district attorney's office, and we have several attorneys working in our children's services division that were in the office as well. So with the cooperation of the Department of Corrections, we prevailed upon them to take a portion of their space, which is across the hall, and that's being renovated, and we're going to be able to stretch out just a little bit.
Oh, you have a budget question. Representative Stoltz, by all means.
Thank you. One of the issues that's come up in another branch of government courts is the need for broadband, and the savings don't always just accrue just in the court system. Corrections, public safety, and prisoner transports, and there's probably some efficiencies for you not to have attorneys on site to be able to or to bring the folks in to do these via video. Have you had a discussion through your criminal justice working group on the issue of broadband and how it affects all the components of administration of justice?
Great question, Representative Stoltz. And I apologize. I don't have. I'm co-chair of the Criminal Justice Working Group, and it just has not come up. But I'm certainly looking for ways to make. We have changed laws to allow for more video testimony by witnesses, for example, and because that is a real cost driver for us, and when in these remote venues. So, but I'd be interested.
Oh, if that question can be developed and by your folks that are. It's brought up that it's savings through potential savings and efficiencies and better delivery of justice, which is certainly even a greater goal is through use of that. But there are also very big asks, and it becomes a little bit awkward when it's not just another agency but another branch of government is pushing it and talking how it's going to benefit the other components of administration of justice. Apparently not as many conversations have gone on and have been alluded to.
Well, not with me, Representative, but I will follow
but
up.
But they're the kind of conversations that may lead us to better administration of justice and savings. When those two are both on the plate at the same time, those are usually attractive targets for acting on.
A very, very valid point, and I know we do coordinate with the court system on other technology issues. We're getting a new case management system for the criminal division, and we've worked very closely with the court system, making sure it's compatibility. I think to follow up on that.
I'm still trying to learn to communicate with them. You know, I'm in a different branch of government, and I don't know all the secret handshakes with those guys and everything. So it's been years of dealing with them, but I'm still trying to learn that mysterious beast.
And I'll follow up. It's a very, very good point.
And on that topic. There's been a lot of discussion by a lot of different departments about the access to broadband in some of their rural locations. Can you comment briefly on do we seem to have sufficient broadband in some of our more remote offices for the what Representative Stoltz is saying would be an increase in different types of practice, but in the kind of day-to-day practice we're doing now, do we have sufficient, or are we having trouble?
No, we have real issues with our rural offices. Bethel and Dillingham come to mind. I don't know about Barrow and Kotzebue, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I think Southeast is not quite a big problem, but those are areas where
teleconferencing would have been pretty good this week.
Pardon me?
Teleconferencing would have been a pretty good option this last week.
Yeah.
But we're working on it, and we're trying to do the best we can. I know in terms of implementing this new case management system, we have been talking to, you know, that's one of the big issues we're confronting is how do we deal with the technology challenges in these remote communities. So I think that's fair to say, Rick.
Something we're hearing from a lot of departments, so I just thought I'd get your take on it while we were in the vicinity of the topic.
Same issues and same challenges, it sounds like. But it's a Bethelite, and this upgrade in Bethel is really just a space deal. I think we're getting cable over to the new office area we're going to be in. But I mean, that's not going to we'll just be on the par then for the whole office up there. But Nome is also undergoing renovations, substantial renovations. We finally found some space, temporary space that we're going to move people into for a short period of time.
Representative Ledoux.
You were speaking a little bit ago about witnesses appearing by teleconference. So how does that gel with the constitutional right to confront your accuser? Has that been determined in a court?
Well, I think it's been determined in courts in other jurisdictions, but not in Alaska. But we researched that carefully before that change was made to the statute, and there was challenges by the Public Defender's Office and I think ACLU in terms of the right of confrontation. But I mean, my simple mind, you're still confronting the witness. He's on a TV screen. He hears your questions. You can see him, the jury can see him, the judge can see the witness. I mean, but there are issues. I mean, I will say that I don't think they rise to the level of where you're trying to introduce, there's no right of confrontation. That's where the big change has been. But it's an issue, and I don't know that it's been decided up here. But
so I might interject. I think part of the larger debate, and I think we had a couple of judiciary hearings up in finance over this, it's not just the video, not the teleconference, but the larger issue has been the videotape testimony.
Yeah.
And that, not to speak for you, but that was a larger part of the debate was the videotaped testimony.
Where it's
especially
not interactive.
Correct.
Well, and that could be Representative Manu,
not
Chair
speaking
Finance.
To Representative Ledoux's question, but it's an ancillary question.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I didn't even realize that in a criminal trial that videotape could be.
Yeah.
Especially some of the cases with sexual abuse of minors, it's been occurring for
judges. Mr. Svobodny advised me that they're not video. I don't think there's real issues with video being allowed. Now, video conferencing, there's still issues with that, but that's there's more. The legislature passed a law in its wisdom to allow that in certain circumstances from these remote locations.
I could be mixing up a law and order episode with a committee hearing, too.
Well, we only wish that our committee hearings were that exciting.
We can get them through in 1 hour.
Anyway,
arrest to prosecution.
So you don't even, am I hearing that you don't even try to introduce testimony through a previously taken videotape, that what we're talking about is just video conferencing?
Well, that impeaching somebody with a prior statement is a different issue.
Right, of course.
That is always admissible, whether it's a deposition. There's no right of confrontation.
Right.
But in terms of allowing a witness to testify on an issue in a criminal proceeding, and you need to present him live, either by video conference or live in person. And as I said, a lot of times you get I guess it might depend on who the witness is, even. But am I saying that right, Rick?
can we?
More conservative about whether the courts are allowing any type of thing. And if I, this is Rick Scott, if I may,
come on, can we get you to come on up?
It's substantially a more difficult question. There's a lot of aspects to it, but Representative Ledoux, the chair, if you're talking about a videotape in the context of a sexual abuse of a minor, oftentimes we are able to get those type of videotapes in, but still the child needs to testify. The courts, except for extraordinary situations, have said that confrontation means you and the witness being in that room, and extraordinary circumstances are where we've actually brought in a professional to say this testimony for this child is going to be substantially more detrimental to this child than other people of similar age. And in those circumstances, the courts have allowed two-way teleconferencing, not the type of things that Representative Stoltz, I think, are thinking about, but the in court, the defendants in court, his lawyers in the next room with the child, and our prosecutors in the next room with the child. So that's what that's to the specific question that you asked. That's how we get in video or audio tapes a lot. In regards, I think, to the other question, and that is that the bills that have passed in the last couple of years that have set out processes for broadband communication, we aren't winning those in the courts. I mean, the courts are saying, you know, it's the right of confrontation. The case law that we read says the person has to be there in court, and no one's willing to kind of take the step and say, oh, gee, technology's changed over the last 20 years, and it's a lot different now than it was 20 years ago in those communications. And judges are inherently conservative about pushing the rules of evidence, and I'm not saying that as a criticism. I mean, that's probably something that most of us want, that they be, you know, very attentive to what the Constitution is. I just want to put in kind of a plug, because it's taken me a long time to figure this out, but 2 weeks ago I had this epiphany what I need to do is say, if you're going to be negotiating a plea to guilty, part of that's got to be that there be broadband communication if there's a probation revocation, that get an agreement up front as part of the of a plea agreement that happens. And, you know, thinking about how do we better use our resources, because that's what we're going to be doing this year, better use of our resources. And that's one way, and we're going to be soon implementing that.
I guess I don't get what you're talking about. I mean,
right now, for example, for a probation revocation, say a person was convicted of a crime, they live in Hooper Bay, had a condition of probation that they can't drink. So now we're having a hearing on whether they were drinking to revoke their probation in Bethel. Instead of flying the person in at $550 from Hooper Bay to Bethel, who saw them drinking, if we negotiate plea agreements, we can negotiate them allowing that video, the wideband communication.
Okay, let me see if I understand this. So somebody has done something wrong, and they've been charged with a crime. And so you negotiate a plea agreement, but at the same time you realize that the guy might do something wrong again, like drinking when they're not supposed to be drinking. So you make it as part of the plea agreement that if there's
a petition
to revoke probation, that can be done using videotape more freely than in other. Am I getting this?
Right. I would say not videotape, but video conference.
Video conference. Okay, gotcha.
Okay.
Thank you.
I mean, that's just one way of, I mean, we've tried the legislative route, and that hasn't worked. So we have to be a little bit more creative, and that's where I'm at
thought.
Right now.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I was going to mention that, but it's Mr. Swapati's idea. He deserves all the credit for it. So I'm glad you mentioned it. And that's in part reflects back to the plea negotiation policy, because quite often on petitions to revoke probation, those would all be a negotiated deal between the prosecutor and the defense attorney. Here's what's going to happen. You guys are going to go back to jail for 10 days, 30 days. It's a big negotiation. Those would be. But now, I mean, those aren't negotiated. And so it does require testimony and a hearing, and Rick came up with this idea, which I think is brilliant, that, you know, as part of the original plea agreement, because there's still many, many thousands of plea agreements on an annual basis that aren't affected by this policy, but there's going to be, if the guy violates, we're going to put these stipulations in the agreement so that we can call the witness telephonically or by video conference, whatever the case may be, and so that we don't have to litigate that when the guy does, which all too often, unfortunately, happens.
I will be fascinated to hear how that goes going forward.
Follow up. So when there's a petition to revoke, does the judge say, okay, it's revoked for, let's say somebody has a 10-year sentence and part of their getting out or is no drinking. So they've drunk something, and you show that they've drunk something alcoholic. Do they then go to do their entire 10 years, or does the judge have discretion that it can be 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? And I guess my question is, if the judge has discretion, maybe you could work it out in advance as to what the sentence is going to be for parole revocation.
Well, the first answer is they don't get 10 years. They now, if he got drunk and sexually assaulted someone and he's ordered to stay off for probation, he can't drink, and he drinks, he's not going to get his original sentence reinstated. If he drinks and assaults someone else, he might very well get the original sentence and then some reinstated. But, you know, most probation violations are got drunk, got high, missed an appointment, things like that. They're not major crimes, but they are, you've got to get their attention, and there's got to be some consequences associated with it. But I'm sure Representative Josephson has been down that path and fought those fights before. But anyway, I hope that answers your question, Representative Ledoux. I want to turn to the civil side for a moment, and I'll field any questions, but just in terms of a heads up, and we are anticipating significant work on the gas line initiative. Obviously, those bills have been introduced. We're understanding there's going to be a fiscal note in the bills for the what is anticipated to be the scope of legal services for next year and beyond, but that is going to heat up, obviously, on everybody's, I'm sure, aware of this on this panel, and that's something that we've been anticipating and have had budget requests in and allocations over the years, but it's been until, I'd say, the last 6 months of this year, or 2013, they were kind of nursing along, and now that's not going full tilt, and we were fortunately, we were able to get a supplemental I can't think of the technical name of legislative term for it, but through DNR to pay for. Otherwise, we would have had a crunch.
RSA
part. Thank you, Representative. I went blank on that.
I actually learned that hanging around here a long time.
No, you did it. Thank you for helping me out. So anyway, we're going to get through the fiscal year 14, fortunately, but next year it's going to stay hot and heavy here until for a while. So anyway, that's something that's going to happen. In terms of last year, I want to mention the Shelby County decision came down. That was a case the state was very much interested in. We filed an amicus brief for the Supreme Court. We actually also fought our own case in Washington, D.C. to get out from under the coverage formula in the Act.
Voting Rights Act.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And our brief was selected by the National Association of Attorney Generals for an award last year. I was very pleased with the attorneys who did that. It was an award. The NAG summer meeting in Boston, which I was not able to attend, but we received a very nice award and nice recognition of the department's efforts. and their abilities in tackling a subject like that. I know Justice Alito mentioned Alaska during one of his questions in the oral argument on Shelby County. And so I think it like to think it was thought-provoking in terms of how this formula applied to Alaska and why Alaska, of all these other states, needs to go get pre-clearance before it can change a precinct or do some other really mundane, simple, clerical change in selection law. So for those who are interested, the bill that was just introduced by Senator Leahy and Representative Sensenbrenner in the Congress does not cover Alaska. So, but after Shelby County came down, we were sued by various groups who were trying to, what they call, bail us back into the Voting Rights Act. There is a bail-in provision in the Voting Rights Act that was unchanged by the Shelby County decision, and so we're still litigating the issue in another case here in Alaska that's trying to bail us back in and to get us back into the coverage formula, which we're actively litigating.
I'm confused about that. I thought that there wasn't anything to get us back into anymore. I thought they held that the whole thing was unconstitutional. No?
No, the coverage formula was unconstitutional, that whereby states would determine if they had to get this preclearance requirement. But anybody, any group of plaintiffs could, for a state that's not subject to preclearance, under the Voting Rights, there's a provision that you can go and litigate to bail that state into the coverage requirements of the Act so that the state does have to go get permission before it makes any changes. So I don't think it happens very often, and we're going to fight it tooth and nail in my book, but there is that survived the Shelby County case. But basically what they're trying to say is even though the state is such a bad actor, and there's, in the state's case, the groups allege that we're shortchanging education for many Native interests, Native groups, communities, and that because we're shortchanging them the education front, they can't vote, or their ability to vote or vote intelligibly and so on is armed or to understand the English ballot and so on. I mean, I'm not monitoring the case closely, but I'm aware of when it happened, and it's issues like that. Now, education is, I mean, what the state does with education for Native groups or any groups in the state is a matter for the legislature and the courts, but in my book, that doesn't connect to voting issues that they've raised. But that's the challenge, and then that case is still ongoing, notwithstanding Shelby County.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jefferson, well, and then Keller.
I just want to get the name of the case.
Shelby.
It was just a no.
Oh, this case.
It's
a new one.
Tunnaneck. I believe, and I'll send.
I remember it now. Yeah.
That's the case. But I'll clarify that if I'm wrong, Representative Keller. I'll.
That's
send
okay.
You.
That was enough, close enough that
yeah.
I clicked in me that I had something on. Yeah.
Absolutely, good question, Representative Jefferson.
So, General Garrity, the term bail-in, can you? Can you spell that for me? Because I'll retain it better.
It's bail-in, B-A-I-L-N-I.
Okay.
That's.
So this is a provision of Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act that survived.
I'm not even sure the bail-in is in Section 4. I don't know that. I have to find out the answer. But it's part of the Voting Rights Act, and there's
okay.
A number of sections that were unchanged. I mean, it's still, you know, if you discriminate against voters, it's still against the law in Alaska and everywhere else. And so. But there's a provision to allow states, for example, states who were maybe subject to the Voting Rights Act or to the preclearance requirement at one time, successfully bailed out.
Uh-huh.
Well, then something else happens and there's other changes or a case or some other event,
uh-huh.
And affected groups want to go to court to require the state to be bailed back in.
Uh-huh.
So whether it's Section 4, I couldn't tell you as I sit here. I'm sorry, Representative, but that's the notion.
Just a quick, the Voting Rights Act was never found unconstitutional. It was just found inapplicable at this point. It clearly was, at some point, it must have been found constitutional.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So this is just a very narrow part of the Voting Rights Act that was attacked in Shelby County. And you can still go under the Voting Rights Act to get injunctions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's injunctive relief that's available
sure.
under the Act to stop a practice which a group is able to prove is discriminatory.
Right.
So, I mean, the effect of the case, I thought, was dramatically overstated in many quarters. It was actually quite narrow and in my view, a sensible result. But, no, you're absolutely right. The Voting Rights Act, its constitutionality is beyond question.
Representative Ledoux?
Has there been briefing done in the Tonanac case? And if so, could we get copies of the briefs?
I'll find out. I don't know. I know that we're in discovery, and I don't know whether where we stand in terms of dispositive motions. Are you interested in dispositive motions?
Yeah, yes.
I'd have to find out. But if the record's not sealed, I don't know why we could not provide you a copy. We'd be happy to do
and
that.
If you'd like to just direct that to our office, we can distribute it to all the members, if that would be easier.
Certainly. Let me find out the answer to that question. If there's briefing that's
been
filed.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Certainly.
Madam President,
yes.
Since we're talking about voting rights, there is House Bill 3, which is in our Rules Committee right now. And I've been doing a lot of work on House Bill 3 and giving it a lot of thought. There's a decision out of Indiana in 2008 called Marion. I think it was Marion County. And the Supreme Court said states could require photo ID. But in that decision, one thing that was really important was that it be free. We don't have a free ID system, and I just checked the DMV. Is that something where, without preempting the governor's right to sign whatever he wanted to sign, where the attorney general would offer an opinion in advance of the legislature taking it up on the floor or the House taking it up on the floor?
Good question, Representative. I mean, any bill that's potentially unconstitutional, I think we'd want to explore and advise the governor about. Certainly before any bill is signed, we would do an analysis of the bill. And so in that sense, we would be advising. But if you know, oftentimes, as you know from your own experience, we work with legislators, and if they're interested in doing something, if there's a way that it can be done that is legal, that removes constitutional concerns and impediments, I mean, many legislators are willing to explore changes. But I'm not in any discussions or involvement in that particular bill. If you're talking about the voter ID bill, is that Representative Lynn's bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, I not any involvement in it. But all bills receive an analysis from the department before they go to the governor.
Thank you.
Okay. We have another 15 minutes. Let's see what we can
You know, there's many pending cases. We did negotiate, and I pick a choose here, and I'm happy to answer questions if the representative have them. Another high point I mentioned, I guess, or a significant point, is the consent decree that we negotiated last year with the shopping promoters, cruise promoters. I mean, that was a very kind of a singular issue here in Southeast with the cruise industry and complaints that we received about unethical and inappropriate tactics on the ships themselves, these shopping promoters, which it turns out work for a separate company. They don't work for the cruise line, but there was complaints about deprecating local vendors who aren't part of the program and overstating and overselling vendors who were in the program and so on and so forth. So we fought a lawsuit last year and negotiated a consent decree with the three port promotion companies that are primarily I think, wholly involved in the Alaska market. So, and we've had some positive feedback from the local communities, sort of from the legislative, the delegation down here, and we met with them and worked with them during our investigation and then the lead up to that. So, pleased with that we're able to in terms of consumer protection.
And that follows up on the on actually the first bill I introduced as a legislator back in 2007 to make some clarifications to those provisions. Representative Ledoux.
So were there allegations of fraud?
Not per se. I mean, no. It more unethical, unfair business practices. You know, the discouraging people from shopping in local stores that aren't part of the vendor program. These are companies that pay to get promoted by the port promoters. Now the promoters have to point out that their compensation is tied to the business that they promote. So it's things like that. I wouldn't say fraudulent. It was just more unethical, unfair business practices. Another heads up, I guess, would be the, of course, the case filed by the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, and I'm not sure if Fairbanks is joining the case or not, but on this whole school funding issue and whether how we currently fund schools is constitutional or not or comports with our constitution, that's going to, has just been filed. I don't think we've answered it yet, but that's going to be receiving a lot of our attention over the next year or two.
Madam Chair,
yes.
What are the nature of the claims in that case?
There is a constitutional provision that says the state shall provide for the public education of citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but currently the state, of course, and communities that have a property tax, you know, those communities contribute a substantial portion towards their local school districts and so on. So I guess I understand the issue is whether requiring and not all municipalities contribute. There's many little communities that don't have a property tax base and so on. So they're 100% funded. There's other communities that don't get it, you know, significantly less funded. So the issue is whether that's constitutional. I mean, that's like at a 30,000-foot level,
sure.
Representative, that's the heart of it, as I understand it.
Well, I just wanted to comment. That would really tip the state budget kind of topsy-turvy if you lost that one.
Yeah. It would. It's several hundred million dollars that I think the state currently provides. The communities provide, pardon me, that have property tax and contribute. And so but yes, huge ramifications.
And interesting, it goes kind of counter to what some people have been asking of the legislature, which is that we actually remove the caps on how much people can contribute locally and allow them to contribute more. So it's kind of an interesting, we're kind of seeing it from both directions.
Now, we're probably not the only state in the country that has a constitutional proviso that says that the state is responsible for education. And since we're not the only one, I'm going to guess that this has probably been litigated in other states. And if my guess is right, how has it come out in other states?
Good question, and I don't know the answer to Representative Ledoux. There was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal 3 weeks ago that talked about a case out of Kansas, and they quoted the Kansas Constitution. It was very similar to what we have in Alaska, and I cut out the link and sent it to the attorneys involved, but just saying for their information, but I have not, beyond that, I don't know.
Could you send us the link, too? I'd be interested in it.
Sure, I can send you. And if you're interested in it, I think there's information that it could lead you elsewhere, but I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Yes, that would be lovely. We'll distribute it accordingly.
The last thing I will mention is the Katie John litigation, which we filed a petition for certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court in December, following a final decision by the Ninth Circuit in July of 2013. An amicus brief was signed by 14 states and submitted in support of the state's position in that case, which we were very pleased with. I think it shows the merit of the state's position. We'll see how it transpires. The opposition brief, I think, is due sometime in February. Then we'll have a chance to reply. So it's not something that's going to transpire this term, if at all, of course. And many petitions are not accepted by the Supreme Court. So, but again, it's something we worked on very hard and believe in, but. It is the end of a long Katie John litigation. It's been going on for many, many years, so we'll see where that goes. But that is the last thing I would mention, unless there's other questions. There's a dozen other cases I could go through, but I don't want to take up your valuable time.
Well, just a quick follow-up on that. It's the same issue as the Katie John litigation, but not the Katie John litigation, right?
Well, it's that's probably fair. I mean, we refer to it kind of generically as the Katie John litigation,
right,
and who the parties were in this last, and it's gone through several permutations. There's been several cases, and I think that's fair. It's when Governor Knowles was governor, it's at the point where he decided not to pursue it. We filed the petition for certiorari,
okay,
on the issue that he, and with all respect, declined to pursue.
So these 14 amici are coastal states, I assume?
You know, I didn't even see the total. Well, Colorado was one, I know. Wyoming was another. They were western states. I think it would be a better description.
Okay.
States that have are concerned about the application of the Federal Reserve Water Rights Doctrine that was used by the Department of Interior the way it was in our case,
mm-hmm,
the implications for them.
Okay.
But western states, certainly, that have significant federal holdings. Nothing else, but I'm happy to answer questions, and I'll certainly follow up on the requests that I've received and provide that information. Otherwise, I appreciate the committee's time and their attention and their consideration.
I guess one question I wanted to ask, I saw a mention in some of the backup materials, is the ongoing debate over how we deal with public records requests. And I know this has been it takes a lot of time, because not only do you have to do your own public records requests, but obviously consult with other departments. How is that going?
Well, it's a long slog, a long, expensive slog. I think most members of the public would be stunned by how much we spend responding to public records requests. And I've yet to see anything newsworthy come out of any of those ventures, but that's not the point. The point is, you're supposed to have an open and transparent government, and people have a right to do it. I think there are some sensible changes. I mean, we've not introduced a bill. It's something that we certainly talked about internally, and I'd be interested in following up with any legislators who are interested in making reforms. It's one of those kind of hot-button issues. If you start making restrictions on the public's ability to get this information, it's really easy to get tarred and feathered with that broad allegation. But the fact is that last year the U.S. Supreme Court said the state of Virginia, for example, could limit public records requests to residents of Virginia. I mean, we get requests from reporters outside Alaska who are interested in Governor Palin at one time, or from the Democratic Senate committees who are interested in finding that information on people who are running for the Senate right now. I mean, we get a lot of requests from outside. And again, these are legitimate. There's nothing wrong with it. But, it takes an enormous amount of time to comb through voluminous email records and for privilege, the process, attorney-client, so on. So I'd encourage the committee to think about it. We'd be happy to share some of our experience. But I think there's some common sense amendments that would not restrict the public's right, but would kind of discourage people from just indiscriminately asking for stuff because they have a prurient interest in finding out about what kind of emails people sent in public office. But I can tell you it's an enormous cost and burden of the department.
And I guess I know it's, I don't want to put more on your plate, but if there's any sort of back of the envelope way to quantify what that is, I think it'd be interesting to know. And it doesn't have to be today. I'm
okay,
saying, No, not today. And I don't want to add to you guys by making that a request where you then go spend lots and lots of time. But if there's any way to kind of back of the envelope it, it'd be interesting.
Well, we've been conscious of just because we see how much time we're spending. And
yeah,
so we've tried to, but we don't have precise figures. But I mean, we can give you some
ballpark,
I think.
Yeah, I'm just looking, like I said, I'm not trying to make this a big research project on your end. Representative Ledoux?
So where are we on the public records law with respect to personal emails discussing public information? And how does the public records law, is there anything about texting in there?
There's nothing per se about texting. The state has a records retention policy that does deal with text messages, among many other things, and text messages that are intended to convey information of value, and I'm not getting this exactly right, but for example, a text message to somebody saying, I'll meet you for lunch, you know, that's not a public record. But information that's intended to be of lasting value, informational value, could very well be a public record. So, but that's an area where I think the law could be clarified, because text messages are not normally retained by service providers, for example, GCI and AT&T and so on. So that's an area where I think there could be an amendment. Private, using your private email accounts to send emails on public information or public matters, those are public records. That was decided by our Supreme Court 2 years ago, I think. So you can't use your personal email accounts to try to do state business and say, well, it's not a state computer, so it's not a public record. That's not the case. If it's public business and you're using your personal email account, it's public record. And if you've done that, then you have to search your personal email if there's a public records request that implicates you.
That's interesting.
This must be a nightmare for the department. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's both compelling because, for example, what's going on in New Jersey now, where there sometimes can be important information, and other times it's just absurd. And I haven't read the decision. I mean, there was a lot of talk about Andrea McLeod and whether she was being reasonable. I don't want to disparage her, but that's certainly fair. And you've sort of described the Supreme Court decision. I should read it. But what is the application of it to legislators, if you know? And I can ask our ethics staff. The focus has been on the executive branch. Do you know offhand?
I don't believe the legislature is subject to the public records. That's right. I've often said, suggested that one way to bring this message home to the legislature is to make them subject to the Public Records Act, because then you'd live the nightmare. But no, I think the answer is you're not subject to Public Records Act requests. In the case of New Jersey, there was a subpoena. I actually looked into that, or asked one of our attorneys to research that a little bit more, because I was interested in the interplay between New Jersey's Public Records Act. But there were subpoenas issued by the committee that was doing the investigation, and many of these, and there were many number of emails, but there were text messages, as you point out, that were very incriminating as well. So, a subpoena trumps the Public Records Act. If you get a subpoena to produce these records, I don't think you can take the position that, well, these records you've asked for with a subpoena are not subject to the Public Records Act. You have to respond to what's in the subpoena.
Right. Although, I don't remember all the details, but the previous administration didn't necessarily see it that
way. Well,
but anyway, that's another.
Yeah.
That's for the history books, fortunately.
Okay. Well.
Anything else?
I think we're right at wrapping up just about at time, but I do want to thank you very much for coming in and giving an opportunity if you had any sort of closing thoughts.
No, I'm happy to work with the committee, even though this is a hearing. I mean, I hope that if something came up and if a member had a question about something that I could answer, that they would reach out to me or to Corey Mills, my legislative liaison on the civil side. So this is an opportunity to talk to the group, but I hope I can respond to other questions if they come up, and I'd encourage you to reach out to me. If that's the case, if it's something I can do or help with, I certainly will. And we will follow up on the requests that were made today.
Good. And, thank you for being here. Thank you for accommodating our rather far-reaching inquiries. I think it was an interesting and time very well spent. This year we are meeting on Tuesdays only, so we are not meeting on Thursday. We will meet again next Tuesday, which is February 4th. We'll be going over the department's 10-year plan, and we'll also be hearing from RAPA, the Office of Regulatory Affairs and Public Advocacy.
I should have closed with that. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Oh, that's okay. I've got it all right here. So we're looking forward to that. Thank you very much, everyone, for attending, and we are adjourned at 12:02.
Thank you.